Wish everyone a good evening and invite you to open in the New Testament to the book of 1 Corinthians. And we're going to spend a couple of moments introducing our study by looking at the first and second chapters and just highlighting a couple of verses that you're likely familiar with. Invite you to open to 1 Corinthians. And tonight we're going to talk about logical choices as well as illogical choices. There are certain things that are logical, which means they make sense, and it's based on knowledge. And then there is the opposite, things that are not of any sense, things that are not logical, and things that just don't seem to match up. There are times in the study of God's Word when we read about one of His selections, part of His plan, or a choice that He has made, where we might initially, at first glance, shake our head at that choice and say, that's not very logical at all. And I'm not insisting or suggesting that we would suggest that God is illogical, because that's not the case at all. But on the surface, sometimes the very people that He chooses to be the heroes, the great men and women of faith, are the most illogical choices that a person could ever make. And I want to look at that and then come away with a big, major conclusion. By way of introduction, when we think about God choosing men to serve Him, to teach His message, the fact is the way that He goes about choosing men is far different than the way that we would go about choosing someone. How we would say, yes, this person is valuable or this person is not valuable, is different than God making that particular selection. We won't read all of the verses in 1 Corinthians 1 and chapter 2, but the Bible is very clear in saying that the way God looks at men is different than the way we as humans look at each other. The way we judge each other is different than the way God does, is another way of putting it. For example, in chapter 2, where Paul continues with this notion of there's a difference between God's logic and man's logic, he says, when I came to you, I didn't come to you with excellence of speech or of wisdom, declaring to you the testimony of God. What Paul is saying there in chapter 2 and verse 1 is simply, the way that I was introduced to you wasn't something that would cause you to be astounded or to think this guy is smart or this guy is talented. Because I didn't come to you with earth-based talents. I didn't come to you with human wisdom. He goes on in verse 2 by saying, I determined to know anything, not to know anything among you except Jesus Christ and Him crucified. He says, I was with you in weakness, in fear, and in much trembling. And then notice verses 4 and 5. My speech, my preaching were not with persuasive words of human wisdom, but in demonstration of the Spirit and of power. And the reason for this is that your faith should not be in the wisdom of men, but in the power of God. The point that Paul is making there, and in almost all of the first chapter, is that I don't look spectacular to other men, but apparently I looked spectacular to God. He saw something in me that men would never see in me. That is certainly not just something that Paul experienced, but that is a very biblical concept where God looks at the inside and men look at the outside. Remember, that's what was stated when Samuel made the choice that David was going to be the chosen king. He says God doesn't see only the outside, but He's able to see the heart of someone. Well, in Jeremiah chapter 10 and verse 23, He says, I know the way of man is not of himself. It is not in man who walks to direct his own steps. The idea being that we speak differently, we see differently, and we operate differently. In Deuteronomy chapter 29, there's the famous statement where it says that the secret things belong to God, things that He knows, sees, and understands that we don't have the ability to see, know, or understand. And so the conclusion that we come away with is that great men of faith didn't look, at least at the outset, like they were going to be great men of faith. And they didn't fit the bill and they didn't look like logical choices, and they didn't seem to make any sense at all. So what I'd like for us to do is to look at five different characters tonight, some in the Old Testament and then some in the New Testament, that, let's face it, don't seem very logical. But notice the point that we're going to make before we close. Item number one, or person number one, is Noah. Consider, if you would, what we know about Noah. I'm going to assume that we are relatively familiar with the five characters. But when we think about Noah and how we are introduced to him, we go all the way back to Genesis chapter 5. Genesis chapter 3 is the story of Adam and Eve in the garden. Chapter 4 is Cain and Abel, and then eventually another child is born by the name of Seth. Then we roll around to Genesis chapter 5, and we see the genealogy and a man that we are introduced to in verse 32, that Noah was 500 years old, and he begot three sons, Shem, Ham, and Japheth. Then in chapter 7, verse 6, it states that when he was 600 years old, the flood waters were on the earth. Of course, this is the man that's going to build the great boat. So here it is that God says, I want an old, and I mean very old man, to build a boat and to save mankind. Makes no sense that he would choose someone. I mean, if I'm going to choose someone to build a boat, I'm going to choose someone who is young, who is vibrant, and who is in his prime. Not an old man walking with a cane. But God says, that's my choice. God says, well, the fact is I'm going to choose an old man in a world that is filled with evil. In fact, chapter 6 goes as far as to say that indeed God was upset that he had created man on the earth, and the thoughts of every man were continually evil day and day after day. And then in chapter 7 and verse 7, it says that Noah with his sons, his sons' wives went into the ark because of the waters. You have a man and his family that are going to be on that ark for a long time, more than just the 40 days of the rain. And think of how lonely that must have been. Yet God took an illogical choice by an old man with evil people who was lonely in a world separated from everything. And he says, that's how I'm going to save humanity. That makes no sense to us. That is an illogical choice. But sometimes God's logic and man's logic don't match up very well. And we're thankful for that. What about Moses? We could talk about Moses in great detail, but here's a 3-minute summary of why Moses doesn't make sense. Consider, if you would, what we know about Moses. Well, he was the child that was supposed to be killed by Pharaoh, hidden in a basket on the river. He is found, divided or as part of God's plan, by the daughter of Pharaoh. He grows up basically as having no family, having no parents, having no family. Then as we read a little bit later, as he grows older and he begins to get smart enough to see what's going on, and he realizes that, hey, I'm not like the other people that live in the mansion, and he realizes that he's not actually an Egyptian, but actually he's a Hebrew. And then he gets frustrated with one of his brethren is being beaten. You remember what he does? He takes the Egyptian taskmaster and he beats that man, kills him, and buries him in the sand. God can't do great work with people who don't come from a strong family, or with people who murder other people. Not the case. And then you go on a little bit further and go to great lengths to read all of chapter 3 and chapter 4. And it's a painful text where Moses makes a series of about a half a dozen excuses why he can't be the one that delivers the people and says, Pharaoh, let my people go. A few weeks ago, we studied that particular passage, and we talked about how Moses gives all these reasons, and we said, no, they're not reasons, they're actually excuses. Find someone else besides me who's more eloquent. He is an excuse-filled man who goes so far as to say that I am slow of speech, I am slow of tongue, I cannot speak very well, I cannot talk eloquently. And yet, God took an illogical choice and delivered millions through that man. So God, between Noah and Moses, chooses two men who make no sense. And nobody in their right mind would have ever chosen those two guys to be these great saviors. And that's exactly what they were. The same is true in the New Testament. And the next two individuals I want us to lump together because of their relationship. James and John, these were brothers. These were two apostles and two individuals who would not only go on to write books of the New Testament, but also two individuals who would be very instrumental in the early days of the church. Do you remember in Mark chapter 3, when we are introduced to these men, that they are given a nickname? So they're not just sons of Zebedee, that's the name of their father, but they get a nickname in Mark chapter 3. It says in verse 13 that when he went up on the mountain, he called those to be apostles, and they came to him. And he says in verse 16, here's their names: Simon, to whom he gave the name Peter, James, the son of Zebedee, and John, the brother of James, to whom he, Jesus, gave the name Boanerges, that is, sons of thunder. The sons of thunder nickname was not something that they were given by their schoolmates or by their friends. That nickname came from Jesus. He's the one that chose that nickname. And what's interesting is here in Mark chapter 3, when we are first introduced to James and John, these sons of thunder, we're left wondering, why in the world did Jesus choose to give them that nickname? Not sure. We don't know why he chose to call Simon Peter at this point. Later we figure it out. And certainly later we figure out why James and John are given this nickname. All we have to do is turn over about four pages in the Bible to the 10th chapter. In chapter 10 and verse 35, this is one of my favorite places. This is one of those places where you can almost see Jesus shake his head in bewilderment. And in verse 35, it says that James and John, the sons of Zebedee, he doesn't re-nickname them, just refers to them as these two sons of Zebedee, they come to Jesus and they said, "Teacher, we want you to do for us whatever we ask." And he said to them, "What do you want me to do for you? Grant us that we may sit one on your right hand and the other on your left hand in glory." And you can see Jesus saying, "Is this a serious request? Are you being for real here? Or are you joking with me?" Jesus says, "You don't know what you're asking. Are you able to drink the cup that I drink and be baptized with the baptism that I'm baptized with?" They said, "Sure, we can." So Jesus says, "You will indeed drink the cup and be baptized with the same kind of baptism, but to sit on my right hand and on my left is not mine to give, but it is for those who've been prepared." These are men who clearly spoke before they thought. Without really thinking this through, I'm guessing that James and John would later reflect and say, "Yeah, that was not the smartest thing to do." For one, they didn't exactly know what they were answering yes to. It's kind of like a child raising his hand so he can volunteer when the teacher hasn't even asked what I'm volunteering you for. You don't know what it is I'm going to ask you to do. What if it's something that is bad? Something that is dangerous? Well, then go over to Luke chapter 9, and it gets worse, or better, depending on how you look at it. The story gets better, but for them it gets worse, because these are James and John, the sons of thunder. And in verse 51 of Luke chapter 9, it says, "It came to pass when the time had come for Jesus to be received up, that he steadfastly set his face to go to the city of Jerusalem. He sent messengers before his face, and as they went, they entered a village of some Samaritans to prepare for him. But they didn't receive him, because his face was set for the journey to Jerusalem." So he's offended these Samaritans. He's bothered these Samaritans. And they're mad at him. And so they're saying mean things about him and giving him the cold shoulder, turning their backs on him and throwing things at him, whatever the case may be. They're not being very kind to Jesus. Well, James and John have a very natural reaction. "Hey, you can't insult my friend like that. Nothing wrong with having that kind of reaction. You can't treat my loved ones that way." And so when the disciples, James and John, saw what was being done, they said, "Hey, Lord, do you want us to command fire to come down from heaven and consume them just as Elijah did?" And that's a question that I would love to see how Jesus' face looked when he said, "Thanks, but no thanks." If I was Jesus, I would say, "Are you crazy? First of all, I think I have the ability to do that. If I want thunder to come down and lightning to come down and blow these people up, I'll do it." But that's not what we are about here today. When Jesus nicknamed these guys sons of thunder, he knew exactly what he was doing. And you know what? You can make the argument, just like with Noah and Moses, that there's nothing about these two characters that makes them worthy. These guys are loose cannons. These guys are losers. These guys are going to say things without thinking it through. These guys are going to end up getting themselves in trouble. These guys are going to endanger the lives of everybody around them. Let's get them out of our group. Except they were perfect. Jesus says, I want someone like that. And in fact, James and John end up becoming two of the three closest of the apostles to Jesus. They spend more time with Jesus than any of the other apostles, with the exception of one. And it just so happens that that other part of the trio, Peter, he certainly doesn't seem very logical to me, because man's logic and God's logic don't mix very well. Consider, if you would, the life of this apostle. Remember how we are introduced to him? He is there working on his nets as a fisherman. He is a simple, most likely fairly uneducated fisherman. He is the man who said, I'm a better fisherman than you, Jesus. He's the one that scoffed at the notion that he should go launch back out and cast your net one more time. He says, Master, we've done it all night and have caught nothing. Nevertheless, I'll go ahead and do it. This was the very man, 10 chapters later, who says, Jesus, is that you out there walking on the water? Keep in mind that James and John and Philip and Andrew and Bartholomew and Thaddeus and Judas, they're all in the boat. None of them said a single thing. They kept their mouths shut. You cannot misquote silence, right? But who speaks up? Peter says, hey, Jesus, if that's you, then command for me to get out of the boat and walk on the water. And Jesus simply says, all right. And Peter walks out there. And you can imagine, I don't know if the other 11 are saying, wow, this is spectacular, or wow, he's going to crash and burn, or drown and drown. But that's what starts happening. The man starts drowning. And you can almost see the 11 on the boat, partly concerned for Peter, but I'm almost wondering if some of them are thinking, he had it coming. He should have thought it through. We almost always characterize Peter as this impetuous individual who, kind of like James and John, doesn't really think through what he is going to say. The idea is that we are to be men and women who consider what we say before we say it, because you can think something without saying it, but you can't say something and then unthink it because it's already out of the bag. But Peter says, no, I'll be this great man of faith. It was Peter who said, there's no way that I could sin. It was Peter who Jesus said, Satan is coming after you to sift you as wheat. It was Jesus who said to Peter, you will betray me. You will deny me. And it was Peter who said emphatically, I will not do it. I will not do it. I will go to my death for you. And then Matthew's version of the betrayal is one where it has Peter not only saying, I don't know who this man is on the night of his imprisonment, but going so far as basically cussing. The New King James says that he swore and cursed the name of Jesus. So he went from, I will die for you, I love you, to saying words that we can't repeat on television to describe Jesus. That's the transition he made. Well, that disqualifies him from being one of God's servants. Yet, along with James and John, Peter becomes one of Jesus' closest apostles. He becomes the author of two important letters. He becomes one of the first elders of a local church. He becomes a great hero of local Christianity in that time. You know, these five men, none of them on the surface make any sense. And you know what? We could add on another sermon of 6 more people or 60 more people. Think about David, a young boy who's never been tested. Josiah, we talked about in detail this morning, an 8-year-old boy who at age 16 begins to make these massive spiritual changes. John the Baptizer is a man who looks like a nut, who's out there eating bugs and honey wearing a coat of fur, and he won't even come into the city, and people have to go out there to see him, and he's the guy who says, look guys, the kingdom of heaven's at hand. Matthew, the tax collector, is now going to go and try to teach to people who hate him because of his profession. Saul of Tarsus is a murderer who now goes to save the very people that he was trying to kill. And let's face it, of all of God's illogical choices, the son of a carpenter who was poorly educated, who got himself into a lot of trouble because he said things that made people angry, there is nothing about Jesus, including what Isaiah prophesied 7 centuries earlier, that you would ever look at him and say, yeah, he looks like he's going to be a king. Yeah, he looks like he's going to be famous. You know, my mother always said that I had a face built for radio. Some of you have to think through that a little bit. But there are certain things about people that you look at and say, nah, that doesn't fit. When you saw the face of Jesus, you would say, boy, that is not a kingly face. Maybe a poor carpenter. Maybe a blue-collar worker who barely gets by. There's nothing about him that you should say, there's the Messiah. And in fact, every single individual that God ever chose didn't make sense when you looked at them through the eyes of men and women. And here's the big takeaway, without being too offensive to you and to the man that I see in the mirror, there is nothing spectacular about us. There is nothing logical about us being children of God. It makes zero sense that God would say to you, I want you to be my child. It makes zero sense that he would say, I want you to be a joint heir with Christ. There is no logic to God saying to people who put his son to death, who we do our own thing, we act selfishly, and we are mean to others, but yet he says, you know what? I'll save you anyway. That doesn't make sense. It's not logical. I think I can speak for all of us that we are very delighted that God makes illogical choices. He chooses things that make no sense. And I'm glad, because if he was choosing things that made sense to us, we would be in a world of hurt. And that would not be good for any of us. I'm glad he chose these men that didn't make sense, and he's chosen each of us. And if you're here and you're ready to allow him to work with you, even though it may not make sense to others, we know it makes sense to him. And if we can help you to become a stronger Christian, to pray with each other and to help each other through some challenging times, because sometimes being a Christian is a bit of a challenge. And we love the opportunity to bring some logic in God's style to your life. If we can help in any way, let us know while together we stand and sing at this time.